This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Do you check your phone, email, or social media more often than you'd like to? Then, like millions of others, you may have a technologically driven impulse control disorder. Tune in this Friday at 11 a.m. for a conversation about technology addiction and how you can break it. Here on KBOO Community Radio 90.7 FM.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud media sponsor of the Q Center Winter Gala, Fire and Ice. Fire and Ice will be held at Castaway Portland, 1900 Northwest 18th Avenue, on Saturday, January 26th. The VIP party begins at 6 p.m. and general admission is at 7. Entertainment includes a performance by two-time Grammy Award winner Matt Albert, and much more. Information about the Q Center Winter Gala can be found at kboo.fm/2013fireandice.
And good morning. It is 8:05 in the a.m. Pacific. Are we standard? We're still standard. We're not daylight yet. Time. And you are listening to Positively Revolting Talk Radio on KBOO, your very own community radio station in Portland. That's KBOO Portland for our station ID. And we are here this morning to have a discussion on a topic we really love, Ani and I. It's called Anarchy, and we have some great guests with us this morning as well. Don't we, Jess?
We do indeed. It's a beautiful thing, this radio, where people can't see the fact that I've just ran
And I wasn't even going to say anything about it.
I know, because you're good. You're subtle. You're awesome.
I'm an amateur professional.
But let's face facts. I'm breathless, not just because of my excitement about the topic, though that is a part of it, but also because I've just ran full tilt from some crazy last minute ditching into. You know, it's really icy out there.
It is.
I got stuck in traffic.
Be careful,
like,
folks.
Mad.
Give yourself time this morning, folks, to scrape your windshield if you're going to get into a car. That's
and
what I'm
and
saying.
To get stuck behind several fender benders.
Oh, on your way. Oh,
people are slipping and sliding. Okay, so that's my true confession moment. Good morning, everyone.
On with
everyone. The show. So thank you both for being here. Paul Messersmith-Glovin, Laura Messersmith-Glovin, board members of the Institute for Anarchist Studies, as well as editorial collective of Perspectives on Anarchist Theory. Also, you're all members of the Parasol Climate Collective and Hella 503 Collective, and we're just pleased as heck you're with us this morning. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning.
Thanks for having us.
I also want to thank Tomas from the IWW for, in fact, suggesting this as a timely topic and getting us in touch, so shout out to Tomas. It's a topic that we revisit every couple of years, really since the beginning of my starting to do this show about 19 years ago. And during that time, what I've noticed is there's been a major, major shift in the public awareness of understanding of anarchy, what it is, that it exists. I mean, for the longest time, I would tell people that I'm an anarchist, and they would sort of wait for the punchline, you know, like, yeah, that's good, pull the other one, you know. But what are you really? It's like we didn't even exist. And when I would say I was an anarchist witch, it just got better. Over the last year and a half, that's really changed, I've noticed. Over the last couple years, it's really changed. And I don't believe, while people now believe anarchy exists, I don't think that people have a much better idea of what it is yet, right? So I think that coming back to this topic and actually sort of exploring what myths there are and what anarchy actually is as a political philosophy is a really important thing to do. And so to that end, I want to remind listeners that you can call in with your questions and comments at 503-231-8187. You can also, of course, keep following the discussion and keep in touch with Lynn and myself on Facebook at where you can find us at Positively Revolting. And, of course, you can always email us at positivelyrevolting@gmail.com. And let's go ahead and get on with things. Let's start with the basic. Paul, what, just at its basic definition, what is anarchy?
Well, anarchy is many things. Basically, it's a belief that people who are affected by political decisions should be the ones making them. So I think at its essence, it's advocacy of direct democracy. And that's in contradiction to our current society in which the state regulates people and makes decisions that are not in the control of the people at the grassroots who are affected by those decisions. So the idea is direct action, and the highest form of direct action is direct democracy.
So does it, that sort of makes me think of that's why there is so much PR about it being chaos, because that the capitalist powers that be is exactly, it's so completely in opposition
well,
to control.
I'd like to make a distinction really quickly between anarchy and anarchism. Mm-hmm. I think it's really important to use those two different words. Anarchism is a discrete belief system. It is a political philosophy, whereas the word anarchy itself does have a conventional meaning of chaos. And I think it's okay to keep those two separate. You know, mm-hmm. I think that it's all right to talk about anarchy as being you know, something with a tendency towards entropy, or maybe even have a connotation of violence to it sometimes. I think when people use the word, they hear that inside of it. But to me, that says a lot about our own fears of self-leadership. You know, I think that there is an aspect to the word, there's a history to it, where we have managed to bury inside of it the discomfort that we've been encouraged to have in our society to make those decisions for ourselves. It's like we're haunted by the power that we might have, right? And so while anarchy is sort of the negative side of that, it's the shadow side of taking control of things for yourselves, of acting without direct leadership or without authoritarian leadership. Anarchism is the positive form of that, where it has its own set of values, and those values are guiding the way that we behave.
Let's go ahead and explore, Laura, a little bit more about what those guiding values might be.
Well, besides direct democracy, like what Paul said, I think that there's the more economic principle of mutual aid, right? The idea of, you know, to each according to their need and from each according to their ability to give. I think solidarity also plays into, like, the core of anarchism as well. The idea that while we are making decisions for ourselves and our own needs, that we are also seeing ourselves reflected in the lives of others. And so it is part of our responsibility then to act and provide emotional or material or other kinds of support to those that are struggling.
And also opposition to all forms of hierarchy and domination. So it's a commitment to total liberation, that we fight against all forms of oppression, so across the board. And that's the development within anarchism since really the 1960s, when it began incorporating the insights of feminism and queer theory, environmentalism, and all these things. And Murray Bookchin actually did a lot to really talk about that as a fundamental principle of anarchism, as being opposition to all forms of oppression, hierarchy, and domination.
And that speaks to me in my own experience. I know I found anarchism through radical feminism, you know, as I was exploring and learning about the different intersectionalities of oppression and how indeed, you know, people have been played off of each other, so that even in liberation movements, we would see the advocacy of, you know, the liberation of certain sections, you know, and the focus on certain sections as a radical feminist to me. And I realize I was perhaps out of step with many other radical feminists, but to me, that spoke to the need of eliminating systems of domination, period.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, that's sort of how I came into it as well. Was I started out as a political actor, just focusing on individual issues, largely environmental ones, and also, you know, queer liberation efforts. And I was looking for something that connected all of these things, you know, because you get used to fighting one fight, and then you see, well, that fight's happening and that fight's happening. Like, at what point are we able to come up with a coherent analysis that connects all of these things together? You know, so not only does it provide a framework for seeing how oppression acts on all the different facets of society, but it also allows us to see how we are together, and that gives us a lot more strength to fight it.
And let's talk a little bit about, you know, anarchists are not monolithic. There are certainly many branches and sort of paths in various schools of anarchy, anarchist thought. Example, anarcho-syndicalists, primitivist, green anarchy, anarcho-capitalists is one that actually I'm just becoming a little bit more aware of, and it makes my head spin around twice. Not sure how you can
say
get
that
rid of...
Again? Say not, that one more time?
So, I'm not sure,
that
exactly.
That goes by my head for a second.
See? It makes your head spin even as I mention it to you. Because I'm having a hard time figuring how you can get rid of all systems of domination and have capitalism.
Well, like the whole term anarcho-capitalist is kind of like saying anarcho-statist.
It's a little like that, isn't it?
Historically, anarchists have been anti-capitalist. They're against capitalism as an exploitative economic system. So to call yourself an anarcho-capitalist makes no sense at all. Basically, they're libertarians. They're anti-statist because the state regulates capital and imposes horrible things like environmental regulations and things like that. So they don't want the state, but they don't want the state so that they can further exploit people economically. And they call themselves anarcho-capitalists. There's also fascists who are now calling themselves anarchists. There's national anarchists who are basically fascists using the popularity of anarchism to recruit people into their racist ideologies. I don't consider anarcho-capitalist or national anarchists, you know, anarchist. I mean, but there's a lot of different people that call themselves anarchists.
Well, you know, a lot of people call themselves many things.
All right. What did one of my next door neighbors has the Cascadian flag out? And he said, yeah, but one of my roommates is an anarchist. And he said, that's nationalism. I said, wait, it's bioregionalism.
There's vibrant debates in this one.
Is there?
Trust me.
Okay. Yeah.
And we can explore that, actually, as well. I mean, we can go...
That could be a whole show.
Yeah, really.
Maybe three. But let's explore a little bit about what is meant and the differing sort of schools of thought amongst anarchists, anarcho-syndicalists, anarcho-primitives. What do these terms mean?
Anarcho-syndicalist is basically kind of a workerist form of anarchism that believes that the people in the factories need to control what goes on in the factories. It comes out of an earlier period, which has been updated by like journals like Process World, in which it was an ideology that was applied to like the information workers and people in offices and doing temp work and whatnot. But basically, the people that are producing things should be the ones that control the means of production. That's anarcho-syndicalism in a nutshell.
Mm-hmm. Anarcho-primitivism is, to the best of my understanding, then sort of the opposite of that, where they're tracing the core of all oppressive tendencies to civilization writ large. And so their analysis, as I understand it, says that the root of the evils that are, you know, plaguing us, that are the sources of things like capitalism, sources of other forms of oppression, patriarchy, are rooted inside contemporary civilization. And so the way back is then to retreat from that. I feel like it might be a little bit more of an individualist pursuit as well. I don't know, Paul, do you want to?
Yeah. Sounds very Derek Jensen.
It is very.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes like primitivists make distinctions and say, there's primitivists and then there's anti-civilizationists and,
right.
You know, I don't know. But they're all very similar in their rejection, complete rejection of civilization. And like John Zerzan says, basically the problem was the invention of language. And when we first put seeds in the ground and began growing our own food, that was the fall from grace. You know, that's his position.
All right. Green anarchy. It's a little bit the same, a little bit different. I mean, there's really various schools of thought.
Yeah.
And I guess that's sort of my main point that I wanted to bring forward because, you know, in much the same way that people who are not, I guess, steeped in the movement might just be tempted to say, oh, anarchism is this one thing.
Right.
And anarchists believe this way.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I guess what I'm trying to get at is really that is such an oversimplification as to be meaningless.
Right.
Certainly. Yeah.
There are a lot of differences between anarchists and a lot of debates that go on within anarchism, certainly.
There's the process-focused anarchy anarchists, for example, and the anti-process anarchists, which is a lovely divide that I get to work with a lot.
And insurrectionists. Right.
So I want to go ahead and, again, remind people it is a call-in program, 503-231-8187. You can call in just like Randy has and speak with our guests, Laura Mastersmith-Glavin and Paul Mastersmith-Glavin, here with us this morning discussing anarchy on Positively Revolting on KABU, your community radio station. Good morning, Randy.
Yeah, do our anarchists believe that there is an ultimate reality?
What do you mean by alternate reality?
Not alternate, ultimate.
Ultimate.
Oh, okay.
As in like an objective reality or what?
Like the table in front of me is solid? I'm not sure I understand.
Do real things exist?
Well, I'm an anarchist and I think things exist.
Okay.
So,
well, the reason I ask, it just seems like so self-evidently self-defeating argument. I mean, one of you said a few moments ago, you seek the elimination of dominance. Well, as soon as you do that, then your ideas are dominant.
No, the elimination of domination, the social domination, where one group of people dominates another group of people.
Okay.
You can assert an argument, and the argument can be accepted, and we can talk about it democratically and decide this is what we want to do, and then that's democracy.
What I hear you getting at, Randy, is actually, I think, a really good question, and that is this idea of how can you have a political philosophy that involves everyone being able to participate equally and this idea of not forcing your ideas on anyone, but hey, you want everyone else to share those ideas, right? Is that what I'm hearing you saying? How can you make it, how can you have a philosophy that you hope that others will embrace without it being coercive? Does that get at what you're thinking about?
Well, it seems to me that that's largely what we have now, acknowledging we never live in a perfect world. We have in America today, in 2013, people can largely do what they want, except for government coercion, for example. But other than that, I don't see anybody coercing anybody else. Oh, I hear there's sex trade, slave trade, whatever. That's awful. That's coercion, of course. That's a crime. But just in the free society, who's dominating?
Right now, there's three anarchists in jail because they wouldn't testify before a grand jury and basically tell about their politics and their friends and what they do on the weekends, and they're now in jail. So that's a form of coercion. Slavery is a form of coercion. Every day, people have to go to work, and they're not really paid the full worth of what they're producing.
What's his face? That I'm thinking of the guy that.
Good old what's his face?
No. Schwartz, who just was, who was really a young fellow working for freedom of just the internet, was harassed basically to death. The list could go on, Randy.
And actually, that's exactly where I want to take this conversation next. So thank you very much for your call, Randy. Absolutely. So another point that in our history, and I love talking about anarchist history, the, 19th century, mid-19th century through the beginning of the 20th century, anarchism was really a flourishing political philosophy with proponents like Emma Goldman, Mikhail Bakunin, Sasha Berkman, Voltairine de Cleyre, Pyotr Kropotkin. The state answered in part with the 1917 Immigration Act, which made promoting anarchism or anarchy, or the idea of no organized government, made it an offense that would actually keep immigrants from entering this country, or once here, would be cause for deportation. And Emma Goldman and Sasha Berkman were both deported under that act. Do you see any parallels with what's happening currently? For example, as more people are identifying as anarchists, as this is becoming a part of political discussion, we are seeing court cases like the recent case against Sergei, and here's a last name I've never been able to pronounce, but Tushinsky, wherein the assistant U.S. attorney, Stephen Pfeiffer, argued that he argued in court not to release Sergei because of the danger of the offense and his ties to anarchist groups, their ties to anarchist groups, saying that our concern is that the defendant is a flight risk because of serious involvement with anarchist activity, which is a threat to the community. And we're seeing judges and DAs using phrases like anarchy is a threat to society, is a threat to the communities. We're seeing that more often these days, and I find that frightening. But do you see the corollary between what happened 100 years ago and what's happening now?
Yeah, I mean, anarchism is not a threat to the community or to society. It's a threat to the state and capital and patriarchy and other forms of domination. I think anarchism today is as popular as it was in its heyday back in the turn of the last century. And also the level of repression is starting to parallel what anarchists experienced the last time that they had large influences over oppositional movements. I think since 1999 with the WTO protests in Seattle and the worldwide movement against capitalist globalization, the anarchism has become the dominant politics of the oppositional movements and of the left, and all the way from the anti-globalization movement through Occupy, and the state recognizes that. The general assemblies that were the basis for making decisions in the Occupy movement that spread across this country and around the world are anarchist in principle. They're a form of direct democracy. The state is currently trying to marginalize and isolate anarchists from a larger movement upon which they're having influence by basically entrapping people, setting people up, taking people to jail, and vilifying anarchism through the courts and the media. So, yeah, definitely.
Right. We're also seeing the state adopt counterinsurgency tactics that were developed initially for responding to guerrilla warfare, and they're including these tactics in the state repression against political activity, like things like surveillance and infiltration, and then an increased militarization of the police. is, you know, things that we're seeing that we saw throughout Occupy and that have actually, like you said, come up since the WTO. It's been like a testing ground for a new form of state reaction to political action. In fact, there's a really amazing book that's coming out on AK Press in this summer. It'll be either June or July. I was lucky enough to work with my co-editors, Christian Williams and Will Munger, on this. It's called Life During Wartime, Resisting Counterinsurgency, and it's a series of essays from activists from everything from talking about the prison industrial complex to the Green Scare and border work, internet security, all different ways in which the state is responding to political action.
Excellent. Well, you are listening to KBOO Portland. This is Positively Revolting Talk Radio. I'm Lynn. I'm Ani. We are here with Paul and Laura Glavin.
Messersmith Glavin.
Yeah. Excuse me.
It's a hybrid name.
I know. It's fine. And I'll get it right before the hour is up, I assure you. Anyway, this is a call-in show, and we've got some callers. Nate, or Nat. Is it Nat? Nat.
Good morning.
Good morning to you.
Nat?
Good morning. Good morning.
There you are.
Hi.
Hi, Nat.
Hi. So my question is, philosophically speaking, not just philosophy, how does is there an anarchist answer to the idea of the tragedy of the commons, with a commonly used resource that is depleted through its use? I understand that there's like the statist philosophy of, you know, imposing regulations, and there are other ideas of imposing privatization as a response to communally held goods. And I was wondering if you're aware of any, you know, ideas that would maybe resolve it in a more organic way, perhaps.
I think the tragedy of the commons is a reactionary ideology. I think the answer to that is, like, looking at, for instance...
Well, not as an ideology, but as a problem, I mean.
Yeah, but I think it's constructed as a problem to make a political argument. Rebecca Solnit wrote a book called Paradise Built in Hell, in which she looks at natural disasters, for instance, and the level of cooperation that is elicited through people coming together to help each other in natural disasters. I think there's the communalism and the communalist project and the communalist impulse and anarchism is something that is to be honored and something that we can see happening every day when people help each other. And I think to say that, like, when people come together and that they waste the natural environment or they don't cooperate, I think that's a politically influenced position.
Well, I think it's a hangover too of our current position coming out of a capitalist economy, right? Like, we're living inside of a capitalist society, which is, it's one of its primary functions is to extract resources at any, you know, at any cost, preferably, like, the more cheaply the better.
Resources that are potentially limited.
Right.
So, Nat, is your question really, how is it that we as people can really self-regulate, can come together and act in a communitarian way to make sure that our commons are used used in a way that is not going to deplete them, that public land, and then we can also get into what is private land, but that our waters are going to be there for us in an unpolluted state. How can we, the people, do that for ourselves as opposed to having Big Daddy, the state, come in or
precisely,
the privatization
yeah.
come in to say, you know, hands off this from an authoritarian perspective. Is that more what you're getting at?
Exactly, yeah, precisely.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, I think in part through developing an ecological consciousness and a realization that we live within a certain ecology and that we need to preserve that and have it prosper for us to prosper, that we're dependent on our surroundings and our ecological niche.
So cultivating the awareness of the importance of our natural world around us.
Right. And I think people understand that.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Absolutely. I want to remind people, this is Positively Revolting. You can follow us on Facebook, where you can find us at Positively Revolting, there at your suffix line. Also, you can email us at positivelyrevolting@gmail.com, or, of course, calling the air room now before 9 o'clock at 503-231-8187. And we have somebody else who's done that. Good morning, Lynn. You're on the line. Good morning. Let us move over Lynn for a moment and talk to Joe. Good morning, Joe. You're on the line.
Hi, Ani.
Good morning.
Hi, Ani. I wanted to ask, you've already kind of gotten into the terrain of anarcho-capitalism, and I wanted to know or hear your guests and you two speak to the way that anarchism reconciles the differences between the individual and the community in a way that is not like the
There was some crazy feedback there right at the end.
That was very dramatic.
The martyr was your last word?
Or Marx.
Or Marx.
Or Marx.
I thought it was Marx.
I think it was Marx.
Okay, all right.
Three to one Marx here in the room.
I think part of the question was about the individual and community, and like Emma Goldman always talked about how I am an individual because of the community. And there's this dialectical, pardon the use of the phrase, relationship between the individual and his or her or their society. And so that we interact with each other and that produces our self and, you know.
Let the record show Laura nods.
Yes.
Right. Yes, she says.
But I don't really know what you're getting at. So,
well, and back to that idea of there being multiple tendencies within anarchism, I know that there are plenty of folks that identify as anarchists that are also what they would call individualists, right? And I think that that philosophy perhaps is boiled down more to perhaps there is no moral ground for any one person to dictate the actions of any other person, and which I think is different probably from where I'm coming from and may not have as much to do with decision-making procedures and mutuality, mutual aid. It's coming from sort of a different place. But I think that there are folks that would consider themselves anarchists that think in those terms too.
Right.
Let me ask you, what about the Institute for Anarchist Studies? What is your work, and what are you doing these days?
The IAS, or Institute for Anarchist Studies, started in 1996, primarily as a money-raising and grant-giving organization. We saw a need for helping develop anarchist ideas and anarchist writers. So we raised money, then gave it away in the form of grants to help people with the writing process so they can take time off of work or hire childcare or do things that were materially necessary to give them the space to be able to write. So that was 16, 17 years ago that we started.
Yeah, and so now we give grants to radical writers twice a year. We also have a small book series that we publish in conjunction with AK Press. We've got several titles out on that now and more forthcoming. We have something that we call the Lexicon series, which we're really excited about. It came out of Occupy, actually, when we noticed that there were all of these amazing conversations happening around the country and around the world, but these were conversations often among people that were newly activated or were new to political thinking, and there's a lot of terminology that comes with getting involved in politics, and it felt like a lot of words were being batted around with perhaps no solid sense of what we could share in terms of a meaning of them. And so we developed the Lexicon series where we picked just some key terms that people use all the time. There's gender, anarchism, power, colonialism,
white supremacy,
right? And then we asked some people that we admire and respect to write just a really short pamphlet about each of these things. And so then we did a Kickstarter campaign and printed thousands and thousands and thousands of them, and now we give them out for free. And so that's another of the projects. Those have been really successful. We also have something called the Mutual Aid Speakers Bureau, which is a panel of interesting folks across the country that are available to give talks. We sponsor theory tracks at conferences, and then in the past we've also done something called the RAT, or Rethinking the Anarchist Tradition Conference.
So if people wanted to get in touch with y'all, where would they go? What would they do?
Well, our website is anarchiststudies.org.
Yeah, if you go to the website, there's a mailing address, and you can email us via the website.
Right. We also have our house journal, which is Perspectives on Anarchist Theory. And our new issue, well, from last fall, actually, we're having a launch party for tonight at the Red and Black at 7 o'clock. It'd be great if you're interested in the new issue, interested in the work that we do. We're going to have not only a couple of contributors to this most recent issue come and talk real briefly about their work, but we'll also have two grantees from the last grant cycle, Julia Oregon and Tamara Lynn. One will be speaking about the relationship between.
She'll be speaking about Spanish people who were exiled after this unsuccessful revolution, who ended up in France and joined the anti-Nazi resistance against Nazi occupation of France. So she's doing research into a little-known subject. And then Tamara
Lynn is going to be speaking about her recent and amazing trip to India, where she got to work with Jonas Sanskriti, which is the world's largest theater of the oppressed troupe.
Excellent.
And that's all tonight at 7 o'clock at the Red and Black. And the Red and Black is located at Southeast 12th and Oak.
And you know what? Joe is back on the line, and he would like to finish his question.
Oh, good.
So, excellent.
I think that's a great idea.
Good morning, Joe. Again.
Hi. Yeah, you caught me at the inopportune moment because I wasn't going to say Marx. I was going to say markets.
And market.
We didn't guess that. I'm sorry.
Marx has a lot to say about the market.
Yes, indeed.
But markets are, I think, interesting as kind of a corollary to anarchism because they assume a certain kind of individual freedom and individual initiative. They are aware of collectivity, but they don't really support collective agency. And so I think this has always been a contentious issue for anarchists, especially anarchists who accept the market to a certain extent, like mutualists who, you know, want worker cooperatives in a market. And so I was wondering whether you could speak to that tension between kind of communist market or communist anarchists and market anarchists.
I don't trust the market. I think the capitalism arose out of a market economy, and I just don't think the market...
And how's it working for us? Not particularly well. Yeah.
Right. And what do you even mean by a market? I mean, it sounds like a Saturday market, like you go down and buy vegetables, but that's not what a market is on a society-wide level. I mean, what do you mean by market?
It's not my word. It's a word that a lot of other people invoke. Economists evoke it in a certain sense, but so do lots of more locally oriented types of community supporters who, you know, see the market as just another way of saying where we come together.
Right, where we buy and trade things.
Yeah, or exchange in some non-monetary way.
Right.
Okay. Any further thoughts?
Shaking of heads is going on.
Yeah, I'm very skeptical about so-called market anarchists, and I don't think the market really has a role in anarchist politics. I think that there's a different economic system that we're advocating, and it has nothing to do with the market. But I come from more of the communist tradition of anarchism than an individualist tradition, which I think would feed in more into a market anarchist ideology. And I've actually never heard the term market anarchist before. It seems like anarcho-communist or anarcho-capitalist,
yeah.
Different way of saying that. And I'm very skeptical about accepting any form of capitalism or a market ideology.
Thanks very much for your call, Joe.
And Lynn is back with us also.
Oh, excellent. Let's go ahead and talk to Lynn. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hello?
Hello.
Good morning. Yeah. This has been very interesting, and I really enjoyed, you guys have hit a lot of interesting things that I wondered about. But the biggest question I have is, keeps me from actually saying I'm an anarchist per se, although I certainly tend
to. Your phone is kind of breaking up a little bit, so
can you move to an, are you on a cell phone? Can you move to somewhere else?
No, I'm on a cordless, which is worse.
Okay.
can you hear me better now?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. My basic question is, what would be the anarchist solution to Hanford or similar huge, huge projects? It's hard to see how anything but an industrial process can really deal with them. And this is acknowledging, of course, that the process has been going on, has done a god-awful job.
Okay. Thanks very much for your call. How would we in an anarchist society deal with the massive toxification of our environment, as in Hanford or other, I'm going to go ahead and put
Say
it out there,
Fukushima.
Other nuclear disaster zones,
any
nuclear power plant for that matter, or other large scale environmental issues?
Well, unlike some anarchists, I'm not anti-technology, and I think we have the technology to do things like clean up Hanford and stuff like that. The emphasis then is like who makes those decisions, and for an anarchist such as myself, I would say the community makes those decisions. So the community should control the technology and the experts that are needed to do things like clean up the Hanford plant. I don't think it doesn't really stump me.
Right. I think just to push that example a little bit farther, like one of the philosophical issues that I run into sometimes is less these technological fixes, but more these large-scale problems that we've gotten ourselves into, like climate change. Like, how is an anarchist society capable of making the kinds of nimble decisions required and the kind of fast and perhaps total action that one needs in order to limit the CO2 emissions to an extent that's actually going to make a difference at this point, right? Like, I think that for me, that's like a better question. How can we make these kinds of large scale, perhaps global decisions using anarchist models?
Yes, I think that question cuts to quite a lot of things. And when you talk about, you know, being able to make decisions nimbly and quickly, as somebody who spent the better part of last year facilitating those GAs you were talking about earlier, nimbly and quickly, not maybe the words I would use to describe our process. And yet, what I would say is that is really, it was such a beginning. Like, we're not used to doing these things,
that
right? We're used to living in a culture of domination, where, in fact, Big Daddy, with the profit-driven motive,
are literally comfortable being told what to do. It's a comfort zone, and this pushes people way out of that, which we're all nodding and going, yeah, that's really good. But it's also uncomfortable. I mean,
where I was going is because we're not used to it and it's uncomfortable,
it doesn't
mean that we should not practice
and get comfortable. It's absolutely necessary.
Because we need to find ways of doing these things that, in fact, can be nimble and can be collective.
And change is always uncomfortable. What's the great T-shirt? Change is great, you first.
Right. Well, and I think that's why you'll hear so many anarchists using the word prefiguration, right? This idea that we have to practice, you know? I mean, it's partly that we want to make change using the forms that we believe in as well. We don't want to make compromises along the way. But it's also about the fact that, you're right, we have absolutely no practice treating one another equitably. We have absolutely no practice taking control of our own lives from the ground up and living in that way. And also not just living in that way, but truly believing that that is the right way to live. And so I think that those kinds of thought patterns, you know, those kinds of conversations, those kinds of decision-making procedures, like you were talking about with the GAs, I think it's really absolutely crucial that we practice those in small and large forms all the time, because that's how the culture, that's how the free society that we want gets built. It's from the ground up like that.
Yeah, in a sense, anarchism is asking more of people. It's asking people to take control of their own lives and to become the decision makers and to be involved in deciding how life should be organized.
Right.
And that a belief that people, everyday people, are capable of that,
right,
which is in contradiction to other philosophies that believe people aren't capable of.
Yeah, I was hearing people talk, you know, in Italy, people are just sort of natural anarchists. They think about laws and they go, oh, is this really going to work? And I heard on another radio station them talking about the, you know, economic, and I'm using air quotes, reform. And, well, we've got to get these Italians to start following the rules and that life will be so much better. And I'm like, oh, no, 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 no. Anyway, that's that was sort of my first, I thought of, think of, I mean, in the 1890s, there were so many Italian anarchists that came over here, and that it's just sort of in that culture, not always following the rules is pretty much considered something you're supposed to do.
Yeah. Right. Well, and it's not just about not following rules or not breaking rules.
Well, I mean, that make, right. don't make and, sense to them. Things that, right. yeah, they're like, you know, traffic rules, I think, are not
sense.
A bad not right. not a bad idea. But that it's the thought pattern that goes through your head about whether this is something that's going to be, as you said, be good for your life or will harm you.
Right. I mean, I get jokes all the time, you know, among my more apolitical friends and colleagues. And I'll say, for instance, oh, I'm going to a meeting. They're like, you know, ha ha, anarchists have meetings, or, oh, organized anarchy, you know, air quotes. And, you know, I always kind of laugh because I'm thinking we're not talking about lack of organization, certainly. You know, we're talking about just a different way of organizing, a way of, you know, of making those decisions together. Believe me, I've never seen a more organized group of folks or a more meeting-driven, collectivized group of folks than anarchists.
Right. That's kind of a rhetorical trick to accuse anarchists of being anti-organization, because it's just that we advocate a different form of organization,
right.
a more cooperative form of organization, a non-hierarchical form of organization. And that's in contradiction to the way things are organized in our society. So the thing to do is say, oh, anarchists are just, you know,
believe in disorder. Well, I was thinking of it in terms of cooperative or uncooperative.
And I think it's a very cynical perspective that says that without domination and without hierarchy, people cannot organize. You know, that's just cynical. I expect better of us.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know?
Right.
I also want to let people know, coming up this morning on KABU at 9 o'clock, Veterans Voice hosts Bill and Marvin will be discussing the American War in Vietnam and the 40th anniversary of the Paris Peace Accords that ended the war. At 10 o'clock, Air Cascadia will be on, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, listen to Flashpoints. They will be looking at the commemoration of the 40th anniversary of the passage of Roe versus Wade. Also, a new report on the dangers of tar sands and the attempt to bring stop and frisk to the Bay Area. At 11 o'clock on the Radio Zine, Andrew Geller hosts a conversation regarding technology-driven impulse control disorders, asking questions like, are you addicted to your mobile device and how can you break your habit? At 11:30, Rob Ritchie of Fairvote talks about his In These Times article, Rigging Democracy, on the GOP's new plan to ensure a presidential win in 2016 and perpetual control of the House of Representatives, all without changing a single voter's mind. And we want to thank KABU listeners and KABU members for your generous support. If you are not a member today, you can take care of that right now by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Because, in fact, we are listener-driven, listener-supported radio. You are the reason, you are the way, the means for these conversations to take place. So please do take some action and go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today. Thank you very much for that. And let's go ahead now, maybe talking to Brandon. What do you say? All right, good. Brandon, you're
Hello.
On the air. Good morning.
Hi. Good morning. So I've been an anarchist for a while, but I kind of came into this show trying to come at it from a perspective of somebody who has no idea, about our politics. And I kind of feel like what's lacking is some sort of practical way for us to achieve the type of society that we want. And I don't feel like that's in this discussion much. And then also what this society would look like on like an organizational sense after, like, if that picture maybe could be painted, I think maybe it would help people understand exactly
Great.
What we're about. And I'm willing to take my comment off the air.
Thanks very much for your call, Brandon. So how do we get there? How do we build this world?
Well, I mean, Laura mentioned prefiguration, which is kind of a fancy way of saying that we live the revolution now, or we live the way we want to live in the future now, and we start learning how to relate to each other in a non-domineering fashion. Also, the red and black was mentioned, and that's an example of a worker-owned, collectively managed workplace. So people taking over the workplaces where we spend most of our time, and people who are actually doing the work making those decisions. So the work of the IWW, for instance, is an example of advocating for democracy in the workplace, and beginning to achieve that is one step that we can take towards an anarchist society. Also going to countless meetings.
countless.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, yeah.
Brandon, I think the way that you framed the question was really nice, which was it's not just like, what will this society look like? You know, are we all going to be prancing around with rainbows and butterflies and everything's going to be great? You know, it's not that we're looking for something like that. It's really, you know, much of society is going to look exactly the same, right? I mean, we're still going to have the work that needs to be done. We're still going to have questions and difficulties and struggles and things. But the structure that we're looking for is things like, you know, if we have an industry, who manages that industry? And what are the ecological implications of that industry? And how can those be mitigated, right?
Also, I think we'd be naive to suggest that, yeah, we're just going to achieve this society in which everything is okay. I mean, there's like Foucault talks about his definition of power in the first volume of History of Sexuality, in which he talks about relations of power and how we're all constituted by power, and that it's getting away from this old idea of the king and his subjects, but realizing that power permeates everything. And the question is limiting relations of power from congealing into relations of domination, so that even after a revolution or an insurrection, there'll still be power relations and contesting ideas and debates. And the thing to do is to have the principle that you're against those relations of power congealing into relations of domination, so that we're anti-domination, and that should be our guiding principle in our democratic decision making, and that it's always going to be a conflict, and society is always going to be, you know, a place of conflict, but that the thing to do is limit the level of domination that exists in society.
Well, it's a totally conflict and domination are so different. They are not the same thing at all.
And yet, in this society, the only way we know how to deal with conflict,
I want to speak really quickly to the other piece of what I heard him asking, too, which was, what are some examples of what it can look like now? What are ways in which we're acting right now? You know, it's not just about political collectives, for instance. It's not just about worker-owned co-ops. I think that in all of the work that we do, whether it be taking care of our children or, you know, sharing food with our neighbors or, you know, growing food that we eat, or like in my instance, I'm a teacher at Portland Community College. And one of the ways in which I try to bring these ideals into my work is resisting this idea that the only expertise can come from someone above me in my hierarchy. The only expertise can come from outside my school. I organize other educators in peer support groups so that when we have questions, when we're struggling with our work, we meet together and we share solutions and we share questions and we find ways to resolve the issues that we're having without having to turn to administration, without having to turn to people that are quote unquote above us in the hierarchy. We find ways of talking together and resolving our own differences and then finding the resources that we need among our peers and with our students rather than having to turn outside, just to model what it can look like to solve our problems on our own, make our own decisions that directly affect the work that we do.
And also practically, we need a social movement, something on the scale of Occupy times 1,000.
1,000, yeah.
Like, Occupy was the biggest, most popular movement I've experienced in my lifetime, and it brought a lot of new people into the movement, which was challenging in many ways as people who hadn't been involved in politics before. But that's what we're going to see in the future if we really want to bring about change, times 1,000. Like, we need thousands and millions of people in the street reclaiming society in a way like that happened in Argentina in 2001. That's happening all over the world right now in terms of uprisings and people's movements and the things like that.
Let's go ahead and take Tom. Tom, you're on the air.
Yeah, very stimulating program. I just wanted to comment on the need to oppose the dominance of capitalism. I want to mention one specific facet of it that I believe is particularly violent and insidious, which would be the pornography industry. I think that we need to talk about that a lot more. It was originally, when it started, was considered to be liberating, but it's controlled largely. It's a male-dominated industry, and it just isn't good for society at all. And also the tobacco industry, but more importantly, the pornography industry. Thank you.
You know, Thank you for your comment. But this is not a show about pornography, particularly. Do you have comments about and I know women who work in the industry.
Well, so, I mean, I think what Tom is getting at is that there's an inherent exploitative, there's an inherent exploitation in what he's calling the pornography industry. And that probably is not a topic we can really broach in the next 4 minutes. But I do thank you for your call. And yes, coming up, say, on a show soon, we should probably explore that a little bit more.
But let's try John. Let's get John in the mix here and see if we can fit him in.
A very quick question.
A very quick one, John.
Do women call into the show?
I was wondering that myself.
They do. But not this morning.
But not this week. Good morning, John.
And we encourage women to call in the show.
Morning, John. Are you there?
It's okay that you're not a woman, John.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, speak up, John.
Or not. So we do only have 4 minutes left, and maybe actually the best way to use those 4 minutes, and again, coming up on a show in the future, why don't more women talk about anarchy and anarchism? I don't know. Okay, so we'll move into that.
This morning they were all getting their kids ready for school and doing other things besides having time to talk on the radio.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, certainly the studio doesn't bear that out. But let's go ahead and one more time for contact information. How do people find the Institute for Anarchist Studies and a little bit more about tonight's presentation at the Red and Black?
Yeah, tonight at 7 p.m. at the Red and Black, which is on 12th Avenue, just north of Stark at Oak. We'll be having a launch party for the newest issue of Perspectives on Anarchist Theory on the theme of care for this issue. And we'll have three authors from that issue and then two recent grant recipients. And then Harjeet Singh Gill from Oakland just arrived last night and is probably listening right now.
Hello.
I'm psyched to hear his name on the radio. He'll be speaking. Just came in from Oakland, and Lara and myself will be there as well. So that's tonight at 7 o'clock at the Red and Black.
And just to touch on this idea of who does and who does not talk about anarchism and about politics, one of the things that we really try to do in the IAS is to encourage folks that do not necessarily think of themselves as theorists to practice thinking about politics, in particular as it regards the work that they do on the ground. If you're an organizer, if you've been involved in street work for a long time, if you're involved in a collective, you have really important ideas. We believe that the ideas that are going to transform society are coming from the work that you do right now. And so what we would like to do is to encourage you or to provide mentorship for you to take the time to write about those ideas and how they can influence the movement at large. So if you are interested, it'd be great if you would come out to the Red and Black, come and meet us, introduce yourselves. We have a mentorship program. If you're new to writing or writing politically, we do help people hash out those ideas and turn them into something that can be published and shared with the larger community.
Well, I'd like to add that people should educate themselves about the grand jury resistors.
Yes.
Right now, anarchists are being sent to jail, to prison, and being held in solitary confinement for not speaking. They're refusing to testify and give information about their political beliefs, who they associate with, their friends' political beliefs, what they do with their lives. And for that, they're being put in prison and being held in
solitary. The whole grand jury system is something people need to educate themselves on.
Right, and what your rights are.
Shows. We have done shows before. We'll probably do more.
Probably really soon, in fact. So that's, I think, the next 5 shows have been now planned during this show.
Thank you
for
so much.
Topics that we have not been able to fully cover this morning. Because as I was talking to Paul in preparation for the show, I was saying an hour goes by really super fast.
Yeah.
And it does. And with that, in fact, we are out of time for this morning. I really do want to thank you both for joining us. Paul Mastersmith-Glevin, Lara Mastersmith-Glevin, thank you for your work. And thank you for making the time to be with us on Positively Revolting this morning.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity. And see you at the Red and Black tonight.
Absolutely. Right. I also want to remind our listeners that you can stay in touch with Lynn and myself via the internets. You can email us at positivelyrevolting@gmail.com. You can find us on Facebook, where we are facebook.com/positivelyrevolting. You can like our page, follow us. We share good meme. All right. And take care. We'll see you next week.
There comes a time when every second, every day, when every January 18, 2013. KABU Navigator Report. Overwhelming support and a record number of donations were received at the close of 2012. Thank you, KABU donors. 6 months of hard work have resulted in a more knowledgeable board and updated board policies, completing a grant from the Meyer Memorial Trust. A new partnership with mainstreamed media will give reporters with developmental disabilities a voice on the KABU Evening News. The KABU Council of Elders will be gathering in March. For more information, contact Lynn Fitch, 503-231-8032, extension 222, or navigator at kboo.org. This has been the weekly Navigator Report. Thank you.
KABU Radio is a proud media sponsor of the 28th annual Martin Luther King Day event. Keep Alive the Dream, an annual tribute to Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., produced by the World Arts Foundation. This year's event will take place at the New Beginnings Conference Center, 3300 Northeast 172nd Place in Portland. KABU will again broadcast the annual celebration in its entirety. More information about this live broadcast can be found at kabu.fm/2013MLK.
And good morning. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. It's 9:02. And coming right up, it's Veterans Voice with Bill and Marvin today discussing the American War in Vietnam and the 40th anniversary of the Paris Peace Accords that ended the war. At 10 o'clock, hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, Flashpoints looks at the commemoration of the 40th anniversary of the passage of Roe v. Wade, also a new report on the dangers of tar sands and the attempt to bring stop and frisk to the Bay Area. At 11 o'clock on the Radio Zine, Andrew Geller hosts a conversation regarding technology-driven impulse control disorders. Are you addicted to your mobile device?